In a time where bipartisanship is nearly obsolete in the United States, it is shocking to hear about a man who managed to work under 8 presidents, both the Democrat and Republican. It's even more shocking to realize that presidents feared him. J. Edgar Hoover, creator and director of the modern FBI, is the subject of today's episode. One of the most polarizing and controversial political figures of the 20th century. He was in a league of his own, and my fingers are crossed that there will never be someone like him again. Somehow, some way, he would even have Donald J. Trump by the balls. To say he was the most powerful man in Washington is an understatement. Washington belonged to J. Edgar Hoover. Perhaps it was all a facade, though. Through the years, his reputation has went from the nation's all-time crime fighter to the one doing the crime. In his office, his chair was lifted so he could peer down, intimidating whoever was in front of him. But I can't help but resonate that with his life. Had one thing broken on that chair, it would have all came crumbling down. Let's dive into the life of the notorious J. Edgar Hoover. I'm your host, Rachel Payton, and this is the Chronicles of Time. On New Year's Day, 1895, America celebrated the new year to come. But the occasion for celebration in the Hoover family home in Washington, D.C. was for a different purpose. They had just welcomed a new child. Annie and Dickerson Hoover named their latest arrival John Edgar, named after his paternal grandfather. Hoover grew up in a middle-class household, but was privileged due to being one of only 2 homes on the block that had the mother stay at home and the father work. It's fair to say that D.C. ran through his blood, because as a baby, his brother took him on walks in his carriage through Capitol Hill, a hill that he would later have an iron grip over. As a boy, he would gain his lifelong sense of competitiveness, learning that he could make more money by carrying groceries faster than the other boys. In his spare time, he created the Weekly Review, a newspaper for his family and neighbors that sold for 1 cent a copy. He struggled with a stutter as a child that he would overcome, but it resulted in Hoover speaking very fast, gaining the nickname Speed. At age 14, he saw the Wright brothers do a flight demonstration and wrote of the occasion that he was the first to shake Orville's hand. During high school, Hoover's father would have a stay in a sanitarium for extreme depression. If this affected the young Hoover, he hid it well. He would join the debate team as well as teach Sunday school. During debates, he would argue against women having the right to vote and in support of the death penalty, but he must have been persuasive considering the team was undefeated. He even graduated his high school as valedictorian. But throughout this all, girls didn't seem to be on J. Edgar Hoover's mind. After graduation, Hoover began taking night classes at George Washington University while he worked an entry-level job at the Library of Congress, which was only 0.5 mile from his home. In 1916, he received a Bachelor's of Law degree. He continued to pursue his Master's of Law, but soon found a sense of community in Kappa Alpha, a fraternity he joined. Kappa Alpha, in my opinion, was fundamental in making Hoover the person he would be throughout his life. The fraternity was founded in 1865 and has an extremely racist background. Confederate General Robert E. Lee was president of the university at the time of its founding and has become a lasting figure for the group. The fraternity has had a history of holding quote-unquote Old South balls, where they dressed up as Confederate soldiers, as well as run-ins with blackface, just to name a few examples. This kind of mindset and behavior is crucial to understanding who J. Edgar Hoover is. After graduating with his law degree, he began working at the Department of Justice, where he became exempt from the draft for World War I. At the department, the young Hoover thrived. At just 24 years old, he became the chief of the General Intelligence Division, which would later become a fraction of the Bureau of Investigation. By 1924, he was the acting director of the Bureau, and by the end of that year, President Calvin Coolidge had made him the official director. Hoover now had over 600 employees under him and immediately began implementing some changes of his own. He required new agents to have accounting or law degrees and would fire anyone who didn't fit his proper description of an agent. He said anyone who looked like a pinhead or looked like a truck driver wasn't acceptable to have on staff. Instead, he wanted a clean-cut, lean, young white man. And if you happened to have been a member of Kappa Alpha, you were almost guaranteed a job. In 1928, an application came across Hoover's desk that would change his life. It was that of Clyde Tolson, a fellow Kappa Alpha and Washington University man, 5 years Hoover's junior. Tolson would go on to become Hoover's shadow and partner throughout life. The extent of their relationship has been debated and speculated for decades. Both men remained unmarried for their entire life and spent all their time together, whether it be working, vacationing, dining, or betting on horses. You couldn't find one without the other. Rumors surrounded the two their entire lives, but if the gossip got back to Hoover, he would send an agent to interrogate the gossip monger. It appeared throughout his career, presidents had heard rumors of the director's sexuality, and it seemed as if many had bigger fish to fry. Elliot Roosevelt said his father Franklin didn't see it as a reason to remove him from his position. And President Harry Truman once told a biographer, "One time they brought me a lot of stuff about Hoover's personal life, and I told them I don't give a damn about that. That wasn't my business." Decades after Hoover's death, a book was written by journalist Anthony Summers titled The Secret Life of J. Edgar Hoover, in which Summers claims that Hoover was a homosexual and a cross-dresser. All of this is hearsay, but has widely been accepted as truth. Without any evidence, however, it's impossible to know. I think Beverly Gage, author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book G-Man, says it best. Merely applying a label does not get us very far towards understanding his interior life, how he himself thought about his most intimate relationships. The fact is that we know very little about Hoover's innermost thoughts and feelings on the subject of sexuality and desire. In 1935, Congress passed legislation making the Bureau a federal agency, known as the Federal Bureau of Investigation, or the FBI. As a boss, Hoover was tough and domineering. He craved control and demanded respect. At one point, it was estimated that about 75% of his agents intensely disliked Hoover, despite their outward flattery. As for the public, his perception was a little different. A 1936 poll ranked Hoover as the nation's second most admired man. He was becoming a household name with a little help from Hollywood. The film G-Men came out in 1935, depicting a gangster turned federal agent, or a G-Man. Soon, Hoover had set up the G-Man University, where he would mold agents into exactly what he demanded. Some agents, like Melvin Purvis, learned lessons the hard way. Purvis was pushed out of the FBI by Hoover because he took too much credit from a high-profile case and became too popular for the director's liking. After President Roosevelt died in 1945, things got a bit harder for J. Edgar. He and FDR had a good rapport, and the men were able to speak openly together about matters such as wiretappings and communists. When the presidency was Harry Truman's, things changed. The relationship between the two men was tense, to say the least. Instead of being able to talk directly to the president, Hoover now had to go through Truman's attorney general. Neither man trusted one another, but Truman kept him on as director nonetheless. By the end of World War II, the Bureau had over 4,000 employees, and Hoover was the head of it all. It would seem that his relationship with the presidents depended on the person in office. When General Dwight D. Eisenhower became president in 1953, Hoover was back in the good graces of the White House. In 1955, the president awarded Hoover with the National Security Medal. While the FBI spent majority of the 1950s fighting communism, a junior senator from Wisconsin was doing the same thing. Joseph McCarthy and J. Edgar Hoover both shared anti-communist views, but varied in their approach. In fact, McCarthy would seemingly not only step on Hoover's toes, but also the president's, irritating both men immensely. His outrageous accusations about communists made the FBI look weak and clueless. Hoover was the keeper of all secrets, not McCarthy. When McCarthy was investigated by the Senate and eventually censured, it's hard to imagine Hoover was anything but satisfied. Although Hoover claimed not to be political, he was a loyal Republican. During the 1960 election between Richard Nixon and John F. Kennedy, he gave his support towards Nixon, who said the director was his closest personal friend in Washington during the 50s. But being friends with Hoover only got you so far, and in 1960, it wasn't to the White House. For the first time, the president was younger than the director, a fact that Hoover never forgot. Hoover was an old man at this point, and a bitter one at that. When President Kennedy made his brother Bobby the Attorney General, Hoover was irate. Having one Kennedy to go through was bad enough, but having another just felt like a slap in the face. Bobby and Hoover never quite saw eye to eye, so it was bitter irony that Hoover was the one to tell him that his brother, the president, had been assassinated. When described on that day, people say Hoover was not quite as tore up as one should have been given the circumstances. In fact, the next day, while a nation was mourning, he went to the horse races. His reaction could be from his disdain of JFK, or it could be from the fact that he had lived through another presidential assassination, that of William McKinley in 1901. Perhaps it was a combination of both. With the arrival of Lyndon B. Johnson, it seemed as if Hoover could finally breathe again. He and Johnson went way back. In the 1940s, the Johnsons bought a house on the same block as Hoover in Washington. This was a much better fit than Hoover and Kennedy, but there was a possible problem. The mandatory retirement age of 70 was quickly creeping up on Hoover, but months before his 70th birthday, Johnson exempted him from the Civil Service Retirement Act, stating, "In my judgment, the public interest requires that Mr. Hoover be exempted from such a compulsory retirement." And just like that, the director wasn't going anywhere. In the 1950s, a prominent figure for the civil rights movement had begun gaining popularity. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was a minister who fought for equality and human rights. Although he practiced nonviolence, he still seemed to threaten J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI. Believing he was a communist and a moral degenerate, the agency began bugging King. They bugged his phones, homes, and even his hotel rooms. One thing the FBI has claimed is that MLK has been overheard in hotel rooms having extramarital affairs with multiple women, and sometimes at the same time. This, of course, is hearsay. Transcripts of the King wiretaps won't be available until 2027. At one point, the FBI sent a nasty, hateful letter to the minister that insinuates that he should commit suicide. In it, the letter reads, "King, look into your heart. You know you are a complete fraud." Another part says, "King, there is only one thing left for you to do. You know what it is. You have 34 days. And as we know, King did not give in to their demands. The irony of LBJ giving Martin Luther King, Bobby Kennedy, and J. Edgar Hoover pens used to sign the Civil Rights Bill shouldn't be lost on one. Richard Nixon would be the last president J. Edgar Hoover served. Finally, the glory of the Eisenhower years were back. Nixon told Hoover that he had direct access to him and that he could now remain head of the FBI as long as he wanted. But deep down, as he would admit to his aides, Nixon wanted Hoover to resign. In fact, the president had set a lunch with Hoover to break the news to him, but once the lunch ended, Nixon had not mentioned it. Was it because Nixon was scared of J. Edgar and the power he held, of getting blackmailed? Or did he just not have the balls, as one aide put it? It wasn't just Nixon who felt that he needed to go. The New York Times gave Hoover the nickname, "the man who stayed too long." I can only imagine felt the way about him that we do for Mitch McConnell. On May 2nd, 1972, J. Edgar Hoover didn't come down for breakfast. His housekeeper knew something was wrong. The director never missed breakfast. Alarmed, he was checked on and discovered dead in his silk pajama pants. The FBI was without a leader for the first time in nearly half a century. When President Nixon heard the news, He said, "Jesus Christ, that old cocksucker." While writing in his diary, he said, "He died at the right time. Fortunately, it would have killed him had he been forced out of office or had to resign, even voluntarily." His body was in the rotunda of the Capitol for Washington, D.C. to come pay their respect. Over 6,000 people would show up. The American flag that draped his coffin was given to Clyde Tolson, who was now frail and in bad health. Before his death, J. Edgar Hoover had implicitly told his secretary, Helen Gandy, to destroy his personal files, which took her nearly 2 months to complete. Those files have been the topic of discussion for many years. What exactly were in them? Hoover's tactics consisted of getting information on a person, gathering a file, and using it for blackmail, or at least threatening it. He did this for many, many people. Let me just name a few. Marilyn Monroe, Jackie Robinson, Eleanor Roosevelt, Helen Keller, John Steinbeck, Muhammad Ali, Ernest Hemingway, the Kennedy family, and pretty much any other prominent figure. He could run a life by simply opening a filing cabinet. He seemed to know no bounds, getting information by any means necessary. This kind of behavior has left him with a villainous reputation that is seemingly getting worse and worse as time goes on. Some believe he is the worst public servant the country has ever known, but I believe soon that will change to just the 20th century, with the 21st century has brought some of the most corrupt politicians one could imagine. They may even make the director's jaw drop. Thank you for listening to this episode over J. Edgar Hoover. For more content, follow my social media pages and subscribe to my YouTube channel. On my website at thechroniclesoftimepodcast.com, you'll find blog posts and citations for episodes. If you have any questions or episode suggestions, email me at thechroniclesoftimepodcast@gmail.com. And don't forget to leave a rating and review for the show. Thank you again for listening. I'm your host, Rachel Payton, and this has been the Chronicles of Time.